for the rest of this hour, I'll look at the emerging science of epigenetics. So, what is epigenetics? Let's start with a simplistic, if extreme, example. If you lose a finger in an accident, your offspring won't be born missing that same finger. The trait for 10 fingers is coded for in your genes, and those genetic instructions remain intact even if your hand doesn't. But what if things that happened in your environment could change the way your genes are expressed in your children? In one landmark study, researchers showed that a starvation diet could lead to lower birth weight grandchildren. Is there something else at work along with the genes? Scientists say yes, and they have called that something epigenetics. They say epigenetics is what's behind imprinting, where a gene's function is determined solely by which parent it came from, not by the regular dominant recessive rules of genetics inheritance. Joining me now to talk more about epigenetics is Andy Feinberg. He is a professor in the Department of Medicine, Molecular Biology, and Genetics and Oncology at Johns Hopkins University. He is also the director of the Center for Epigenetics for the Epigenetics of Common Human Diseases there. He joins us by phone from Maine. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Feinberg.
That's a pleasure, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's nice to have you on the show because I think we really need to try to help people understand this field. It's very interesting. But how would you describe or define epigenetics? What is it?
Well, I have to say it's a pleasant surprise to be asked to talk about this publicly because I've been working in this field for 20 years, and really, it's only very recently that anybody cared about it. So what epigenetics is, it's a form of genetics, but genetics is the science of heredity, and we've thought that heredity involves the DNA building blocks, the four nucleotides of DNA, and that's that. But we now know that there's more to the story than that. There's other ways that information can be preserved when a cell divides and maybe even transmitted from a parent to a child besides the DNA sequence itself. And there are chemical changes in the DNA, and there are also chemical changes in the proteins around which the DNA is wrapped inside of the nucleus. And that's what we refer to as epigenetics. It's a different kind of information, but it's doing similar things that the genes do too.
So what's the significance of having changes in the chemicals around which the DNA is wrapped in terms of, you know, disease or development or anything like that?
Well, I guess the significance is that purely genetic explanations of both normal development and also disease may not explain everything. And there's several reasons to think that's the case. One of them is that as people solve the genome code through this wonderful joint effort, international effort, one of the things that was discovered was that a lot of the sequence that's in there that's conserved, in other words, that's similar from one species to another, isn't in the coding sequence of genes. And much of that sequence, that non-exonic sequence that's conserved, is potentially and in fact marked with these chemical changes. So there's this hint that there might be a good deal of information in the cell that's not just the DNA sequence, but that it might involve these sorts of chemical changes. Another reason is there's actually evidence. There are rare syndromes. We've been working on one for a number of years called Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, but there are other ones as well that clearly involve epigenetic change that is responsible for the disease. But there's a common disease that we've known about now for 20 years, and that's cancer. We know that many of the changes in cancer are epigenetic, don't involve DNA sequence change, but involve things like DNA methylation, a chemical change in cytosine. So naturally, people have started to ask, and we're one of them. We're not the only ones, but we're really trying to get into this in a serious way, whether other diseases besides cancer might also involve epigenetic change.
So what is this? I mean, this shorthand you just used, DNA methylation. What are you talking about there? What does it mean to methylate DNA?
Well, methyl is a carbon with three hydrogens attached, and
I remember
fairly
ethyl,
simple.
Methyl, ethyl, and propyl, right?
yeah. Don't ask me to keep going.
Okay.
it's a fairly simple chemical change that occurs on one of the four building blocks, specifically the cytosine. So the methylation is called methylcytosine, and we actually know an awful lot about that now. We know not only how the methylation patterns are maintained when a cell divides, the enzymatic machinery that's responsible for that, but we know a lot about the sequences that are targets for that modification, and we even know a lot about the proteins that recognize those changes. But we know that there are a lot more epigenetic changes inside of a cell that are possible and that have been found, although we know a lot less about how they're controlled.
Now, about 10 or 12 years ago, or maybe even longer, I was actually at the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine, and I think you're there now for the genetics course.
Yes, and I should say, we're here. This is another wonderful piece of history. Dr. Victor McCusick started this course over 40 years ago, and the human geneticists get together with the mouse geneticists here every summer for a couple of weeks and teach this course, and I myself was a student in it.
Well, I went there as a journalist because they had a course for journalists, and they talked about imprinting 12 years ago, and I guess that's the first time I heard about epigenetics. But remind us what imprinting is. That's a kind of epigenetics.
Yeah, it certainly is. So what imprinting is, it's sort of technically the way to describe it is parent of origin specific gene silencing. But the explanation
Wait a minute. Parent of origin specific gene silencing. Okay, let's take that apart.
Well, let me take that apart. So you have two copies of every gene, one from mom and one from dad. For some imprinted genes, only the copy that you inherit from mom functions. And for other imprinted genes, only the copy that you inherit from dad functions. Normally, that's the way it's normally supposed to be. And when it was discovered, it was very surprising because it means that there are some traits that are inherited only from one parent because the other parent's irrelevant. The gene is non-functional when it's passed on to you.
Interesting. So is that the phenomenon that leads to disease if the imprinting isn't working properly?
Yeah, so that's right. So one of the things that we've worked on is an abnormality of imprinting that appears to be very common in cancer. We first discovered it in childhood tumors of the kidney, but now many others have been looking at this, including us, and it seems to be an abnormality that's present in many tumors. About a year ago, Dr. Tsui and our group discovered that there is a very common abnormality of imprinting involving a gene called insulin-like growth factor 2, which is a growth-promoting gene. Normally, only one copy of that gene is supposed to be functioning in cells, but in about 10% of the population, both copies are functioning, and that property was associated with a history of colon cancer, both in the patients and also in family members. So the implication is that this might be a common variation, albeit an epigenetic one, that increases the risk of developing disease, in this case cancer. But it could be common.
Strange. Well, this is an interesting new field, and if you'd like to join the discussion, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from Mike in Ithaca, New York. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I'd like to throw something out there, give it away to anyone who wants to crack at it.
Okay.
This is a way one could prospect for occurrences of genetic imprinting in nature without using lots of expensive equipment, though it might take a lot of your time. It would be affordable, and any amateur could work on this.
Ooh.
And that exists in the sex ratio in flying ants. You know, in a normal ant colony, there are legions of workers that are produced from the brood to replace ones that die off or to increase the workforce. But once a year, they produce a batch whose only purpose is to spread the genes of a colony. And these are winged males and females, and they're all kicked out on the same day, even within minutes of each other, in any one district for any one species to promote outbreeding and also predator swamping, and then these mate in the air with members from other colonies, and then the females drop down, shed their wings, and attempt to found new colonies as queens of new colonies. Now, if the workers could have their druthers, they would like to female bias by weight this swarm that they produce, because they're three times more related to their sisters than they are to their brothers, because of this queer habit that ants have of having males that only have one of each gene, so that the males produce sperm by cloning. So because of this, they're more three times more related to their sisters than they are to their brothers.
Mike, hang on a second. I just want to turn to Andy Feinberg and say, are we talking about imprinting or epigenetics in this?
You know, I think I'm going to guess that because Mike's calling from Ithaca, perhaps he's affiliated with Cornell, but he certainly knows a lot more about the entomology than I do. It's very interesting. The original, I don't know, I didn't know anything at all about the ant story, and I was having a little trouble following it, but I will say that the original word, imprinting, was coined by Helen Krauss, who was an insect scientist, and she did observe that there was a selective rejection during development of the paternal genome in a particular type of insect. And so imprinting doesn't necessarily have to just mean the specific silencing of genes. It could also be the way that the chromosomes are handled selectively. I think there's another interesting thing, though, that Mike touches on that just rang a bell in my head about the natural world. And the contrast with mice, as much as I love mice, and I do, and we do mouse experiments as well, because we can answer critical questions in that way, there was a discovery made a few years ago that someone went and examined what was the basis of the very first mutation that was ever discovered by anybody at all, namely Lineck.
Hey, Andy yeah. Feinberg, can you hold on one second?
Yeah, sure.
I just need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay,
so,
back to Lineck.
So the very first mutation that was ever discovered, it's a symmetry mutation in a plant, and it turns out to be caused by a methylation variation and not by a conventional genetic mutation. And the authors of that study that was published in Nature said, well, you might think this is really strange, but we think there's something maybe a little strange about laboratory animals that have been inbred for many generations, and maybe there's more epigenetic variation and heterogeneity in the natural world and in the natural population that you might not pick up through inbred laboratory animals. I think they have a point there, and I think Mike touches on an interesting question.
Okay, let's try Kevin from Cape May, New Jersey. Kevin, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Hi, yes. I'm just calling. I work with developmental disabilities, and one interesting rare developmental disability that I deal with is Klinefelter syndrome, which on a very general explanation that I understand is it is an extra X chromosome. So a person with Klinefelter's is XXY, and it only happens in male. And after listening to your discussion, I'm wondering if this is an epigenetics is a term that just recently I got introduced to, and I'm wondering if this is in an epigenetic disorder.
Well, it's strictly speaking not, because it's a chromosomal disorder in which there's an extra dose of a chromosome, but it's possible that some of the behavioral differences are due to an imbalance between X in terms of dosage of X chromosome. And there's a reason to think that in Turner syndrome, which is an XL, so there's absence, there's only one sex chromosome, the X chromosome, researchers observed several years ago behavioral differences in girls with Turner syndrome who had inherited their X from the mother versus those who inherited the X from the father. And the idea was that there might be different patterns of gene expression on one X versus the other X. So there could be kind of an epigenetic connection, but you wouldn't call the mechanism of Klinefelter's epigenetic, strictly speaking.
Okay, thanks for that question.
Sure.
It does sound to me like there's a whole world out there that we're going to have to pay closer attention to.
Yes, that's what we think, that's for sure.
All right, and just quickly, what's the future of this? Do you think that there's going to be, are more labs jumping into this?
Well, I think so, and one of the things that we're hoping is to help to develop an infrastructure for the study of epigenetics in a genomic way. So up to now, people have been studying epigenetics at the gene level, but we haven't had available the tools like the Genome Project has made available for the study of conventional genetics at a whole genome level. And I think it's going to be very important to do that. Having ways of looking at imprinting at a genome level and methylation at a genome level so that one can then do population studies without knowing in advance what your candidate gene target is, in a way do an epigenome scan and try and relate epigenetic changes to disease. We think that's going to be very important.
Okay, Andy Feinberg, thanks very much for that description. Andy Feinberg is professor of the Department of Medicine, Molecular Biology and Genetics and Oncology, and director of the Center for Epigenetics of Common Human Diseases at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Earlier we spoke to Karen Rader, author of Making Mice, and Barbara Knowles at the Jackson Laboratory. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick, Paul Masiello, and Rigo Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinh. You can email us with questions. Our address is scifry@npr.org, or surf over and visit us at our website, www.sciencefriday.com. Ira Flatow returns next week. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.